Today we're going to be talking about how to roll your own ISP, your own internet service provider. I'm sure that loads of people have thought to themselves when their Virgin or their BT system's not working, I could do better than that, set up my own ISP.
I'm gonna go build my own with blackjack and hookers.
Chris Ferrender, welcome to the Cyber Show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Hi Chris, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into digital tech?
Yeah, I mean, basically I did have a education in engineering. I did HND engineering course back when I was, after I did A-levels. So that was like a, well, HND, it's not a degree, but it is kind of a degree level course, but it was designed more for industry, I believe, rather than academia. But actually, it was an incredibly good course. So we did electronics, we did IT, and all across the board, really, chemistry, math. So it was a good grounding, I think, in general engineering. After I finished that course, I actually ended up working in photography, which was kind of nothing to do with that. I actually worked for Kodak for about 3 years as a lab engineer. I ended up meeting a chap at a rave, actually, back in the 90s, and he was running an independent photo lab out in Freshwater on the Isle of Wight. So I ended up working for him, but it was a bit more, we had a bit more diversity in his business. So we actually had a little internet cafe. We did web design and print services, that kind of thing. So I think it was kind of like learning a bit about web design and doing the internet cafe that got me kind of down the road of networking and IT. And it was actually during working at that business that I kind of, well, I mean, it was my project, although the chap who ran that business, John Bailey, it was called JCB Imaging, and it's actually still running today, believe it or not. So he helped me out a bit, and it was actually on the roof of his shop where we set up the first wireless access point, and that was back in 1999, I believe. And the idea was that we would invest in a high-speed connection to the shop, and we'd actually be able to share it around the village. So, because, I mean, back in those days, you know, everybody was just using dial-up internet. So you're talking 56K modems, dial-up. So actually, fast connections weren't available, you know, to the general public. And in actual fact, there was very little available even through British Telecom back in those days, believe it or not, especially in rural areas.
So which rural area are you in, and why do you not have those connections back in 1999?
I mean, in 1999, I don't think anybody actually had, I don't think broadband was available generally, even in many cities in those days. You're talking kind of the days before ADSL technology was widely available. I think it was probably starting to become available in cities at that time. But certainly, yeah, not really outside of London or big cities, I believe, back in those days.
And you're on the Isle of Wight, is that correct as well?
So that's right.
A bit more rural than the mainland.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, essentially, you know, it's the same. We have the same British Telecom services, and funnily enough, some of the little exchanges, like what I used to live in a village called Brystone when I was slightly younger with my parents. And actually, the Brystone telephone exchange was the first one in the entire country to go digital, believe it or not. But that was kind of like, I think they kind of used it as a test bed, because they'd really sort of, there was a lot of development going on back in the late 70s and 80s. So a lot of those little villages, they actually went from a few thatched cottages, and they built all those kind of estates, you know, like you see all around South Coast these days. I think they actually built the brand new telephone exchange sort of as the development was happening. But yeah, so, I mean, it's not completely backward, the island. It does definitely economically worse than the mainland.
Some of our listeners from further afield may not know that the Isle of Wight is one of the most technologically innovative, shall we say, little bits of England. It's where hovercrafts come from. And at one time, Britain had a space program. We had our own space program, and that was based on Tennyson down on the Isle of Wight. It's actually quite a strange little corner of the world for really advanced innovation, isn't it, Chris?
Yeah, and funny you say, you talk about Tennyson. I believe Marconi did one of the first wireless transmissions from Allen Bay, which is just at the bottom of the hill from Tennyson down, where that rocket station is. So yeah, there's a lot of stuff happens here. Yeah, and it actually radar is industry is quite big here as well. It used to be called Plessy's. I believe it's now BAE Systems, but they actually manufacture and design the over-the-horizon radars that the military vessels use.
Long, long time ago, back in uni, it was a Ray called Plessy at the time, and we did a little bit of history there on the early development of radar along the south coast from kind of Portsmouth over to Poole and the Purbex, and there were lots of antenna and weird experimental stations on the Isle of Wight.
Yeah, Boniface Down in Ventnor was one of the early rotor stations, which was back in the Second World War time. Funny enough, actually, my uncle was an engineer at Plessy, and he designed the microwave landing system that the military used back in the 80s.
So you started off with setting up your village with that faster connection. How did you go from that to setting up an ISP? Can you give us a history of how that became the company you work for today?
Yeah, I guess it just naturally grew, really. I mean, the initial project back in 1999 and 2000, legally you couldn't operate a WISP commercially. There was a regulation, an Ofcom regulation, that said you could only do it as, you know, a community group or a charity. So initially what happened was I actually got an EU grant of £10,000 through the CEDA organization, and that money we actually used to build the first mast and buy some equipment. And there was also grants available for getting satellite broadband, because actually back in those days, you know, you couldn't even get a high bandwidth service from BT at that time. We tried for ages to get something from them, but I don't think they had any sort of high capacity data going to the telephone exchange at all back in those days. So in actual fact, satellite was the only viable option for getting a high-speed connection. So yeah, with the EU grant and the grant for satellite broadband, that was really the very first incarnation of the service. And it was a 20 megabit satellite link, which we fed into a Linux router, and then that fed into the wireless access point. So in those days, you couldn't even buy outdoor Wi-Fi gear either. So we actually had to, you know, modify indoor kit to work outside. So we'd, you know, mount the equipment inside boxes, IP rated boxes, so they were weatherproof. So it was a proper sort of Heath Robinson type setup. And really what happened was that kind of grew, I think it was over about 5 years. I mean, I ran that quite happily, just as a sort of one-man operation. And what I did was, you know, where the signal degraded or where the coverage didn't exist. We actually had quite a lot of people inquiring about it. So if a customer was looking for the service and they were kind of on the border of where the signal was available, sort of say to them, well, look, if you let me stick a booster on your house, I'll give you a free service. So just really by doing that, the network grew to cover the most of the West Wight, really. We did Freshwater Bay, Totland, Freshwater Town and Yarmouth. And that was really just done like that, really, using people's property to host boosters in exchange for free broadband. Probably had about 100 customers in the village, so it was quite a good little income for me as a one-man band. And I'd also end up, you know, doing a bit of IT work for people, you know, fixing computers and stuff. So it was a good little income, really, just as a small operation. And then one of my customers who ran the Ferringford Hotel, they were using the service for a few years and they actually decided to invest in it. So with the investment money, what we actually did was we then set up as a proper ISP, really. So we actually became members of RIPE, the organisation that manages IP addresses in Europe. And that meant we could actually get allocations of IP addresses. We expanded the network to cover the whole Isle of Wight. I mean, in those days, it was still, even, I think this is in about 2008 by this point. So it was still actually quite difficult to get bandwidth. You know, for example, a 2 megabit lease line through BT, they charged about £20,000 a year. So it wasn't really feasible cost-wise to use BT, you know, as a backhaul provider. So what we actually ended up doing, we realized that bandwidth costs in data centers were actually very reasonable, even in those days. So what we actually did was we found a company in Bournemouth. It was called Connections for London. I'm not actually sure if they're still going. I mean, I'm sure the data center would still be there because the amount they invested in it. But I don't think the company operates under that name anymore. But that was kind of up on the hilltop. And that actually had a clear line of sight over to Tapnell Farm, where we had one of our masts. So what we did was we made a deal with them where we rented a bit of roof space and we actually set up 2 wireless backhauls to their rooftop, and that enabled us to buy the bandwidth from their data center pricing, which was very, very reasonable. And obviously we managed the network links to get it over to us. So that was really how we managed to do that. Yeah, that meant we were then able to have proper BGP connectivity on the border of our network.
I was just wondering about this whole bandwidth market back in the end of the 90s and the turn of the century. Was it competitive or did you find it BT still held a monopoly?
Definitely. I think it was before Openreach. It was definitely a monopoly. Yeah. And obviously they didn't really want people going in competition with them. So I think they did price bandwidth really, so it wasn't practical to wholesale.
Can you remember who your satellite provider was when you had a sat up link?
Yeah. We had a couple of different ones actually. The first one was from Hughes, which was this big American electronics and defense company, isn't it, Hughes? They had a service available with their own hardware. We found it was quite challenging to use that one because it was, the modem was USB based and it actually only had Windows drivers. So the very first incarnation, you can probably imagine how unreliable the Windows router is. I remember it crashed all the time. We ended up having to write a little script that restarted it every every few hours. So yeah, that was really bad, and that you couldn't get an Ethernet bit of hardware. And then there was a new company came out called Aramisca, which was a company in Belgium, and they had a much better service that was available that actually had an Ethernet connection. So it meant we could use, you know, much better routers. So we actually used Linux routers. We had a few different ones, actually. I think the first one we used was by Smoothwall, and that was actually a kind of router firewall software. And eventually we ended up using Microtech, which is a Latvian company. Their stuff was actually really, really reliable, and it had so many features that it beat what you could do with Cisco.
You're listening to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk.
For our listeners who are thinking about Starlink and so on, let's just distinguish that in those days you would have been pointing dishes at geostationary.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, the downside to those connections back then was the latency, because I mean, that's what Starlink's done that makes it much of an improvement over those, is because the distance from the Earth to be geostationary, I think the ping, I seem to remember the ping time was about 200 milliseconds. So it was actually noticeable, and a voice call, for example, had a delay on it, a bit like, you know, when you see on the news when they use a satellite link.
So you didn't have any Counter-Strike and Doom players on your...
No, that was... Yeah, one of the downsides, really, with the satellite stuff, it didn't really support gaming or voice. I mean, it was good download speed, to be fair. But yeah, latency certainly was a downside to it.
So what kind of software does an ISP need?
Yeah, you need to be able to control the speeds to customers. You do need quality of service as well, especially if you're using contention, which pretty much or even modern day fiber ISPs operate on a contention model. So obviously the total amount of bandwidth coming into the company is not enough for every single person to download the maximum speed of their connection all at the same time. We didn't really have contention ratio as such, but what we did do was we monitored the capacity on all the links. Back then we were using a software called Cacti, which uses SNMP, and it actually measures the link speeds and draws graphs on it, so you can actually see what capacity links are running at. You would also need monitoring software, so we used to use a tool called Nagios. And that really just pings all of your devices, so it can alert you to a device being down or something on the network being down. Most of the quality of service was handled by the actual routers. So I think I mentioned a minute ago, Microtech, they were one of the key players in the early WISP business, because they had really well-featured router software that you could run it on PC hardware. And they also made their own little router boards as well, which were like basically just a bit like a Raspberry Pi, I guess. So you could run those on masts and things. They would just basically function as a little computer that ran off 12 volts or 24 volts. So you could run it off of sort of low-cost UPS system or something like that. One of the reasons we started using that was because it had a good QoS functionality, so you could actually set certain speeds for certain customers. You could also manage the overall bandwidth. They had a thing called a PCQ connection queue. That meant that if the total bandwidth did become saturated, it would actually share it out quite nicely, equally to the users. So, you know, you may see a slight drop in speed, but it actually meant, like, if you didn't have any quality of service, what you tend to find with on-routers is the person opening the highest number of connections gets an unfair share. So yeah, that system is kind of invaluable, really, back in those days. In terms of billing, it all kind of integrated quite nicely, actually, because what I actually did was, I was quite good at coding, so I actually wrote my own billing software. So basically, you have a Radius server which talks to the routers. So when a customer's router connects using a PPP tunnel, what happens is the router contacts the Radius server, and the Radius server sends back the customer's speed profile, the IP address they would have, and, you know, all the kind of bits of information needed to set a customer's connection. And then I'd written like a kind of web portal, so customers could actually subscribe, unsubscribe, they could buy top-ups, pretty much do everything themselves, really. So, for example, when a customer got installed, they'd go to the web portal, would cut the MAC address of their equipment. So then they basically would sign up, put in their user details, name, address, and such. And then they'd be given an option to subscribe, or you could, we did pay as you go as well. So we actually limited bandwidth use, because obviously on wireless there is limited airtime. So a bit like the mobile phone companies, really, we managed it by having a certain monthly bandwidth quota. So for example, they could sign up for like a 10 gig or 100 gig monthly package, and then if that ran out, they would be able to buy top-ups. And it was all done through web portal, which was all done through PHP. That actually worked using a hotspot system on the routers. So when the customer first connects, it throws up the splash page, which identifies the MAC address of their equipment. And then, yeah, they could buy top-ups, subscribe, unsubscribe. It was all completely automatic. And the payments went through either card processing company.
So on the, you know, customers having that sort of bandwidth restriction or being able to top it up, did you get any problematic customers, people who were topping up excessively and using quite a lot of bandwidth? And how did you deal with that?
I mean, we obviously, it's our job to make sure we have the capacity, essentially. I mean, most people really, especially if you think back to like the 2000s, you know, there wasn't actually as much bandwidth intensive stuff on the internet, really. Not like today where everyone's video streaming. There was little video streaming. So I'd say the average person didn't really use that much. You know, obviously we wanted people to buy top-ups, you know, so we weren't complaining the more money they spent, but we were charging quite a lot. You know, if you compared it to today's pricing, you'd never believe people would pay for it. So I think we were charging about £50 a month for 10 gigs or something, and that would go up to about 30 megabits per second. But you got to remember that people just couldn't get broadband through any other means, really. So we were able to sell it at that price. But yeah, I just don't think there was so much content on the internet back then.
I was gonna say, do you remember that You Wouldn't Steal Your Car pirate advert? And there's that 10-year-old at the end on the old computer smiling at the camera because she just downloaded like an entire collection of films. I was that 10-year-old. We were definitely abusing it back then.
Yeah.
But people weren't able to notice it, you know, and by poor street were probably wondering why they can't get on the internet right now.
As fledgling internet service provider grew, kind of growing pains did you experience? I mean, how did it scale, and where were the pain points with competition or resource limitations and things like that?
It's quite interesting, actually, because I mean, I can't honestly say we had any like major problems. I mean, kind of the worst thing that could happen really was we had, you know, like quite often on the Isle of Wight, you do get quite bad storms. We did have a couple of masts had got damaged during some very high winds a couple of times. So that was kind of like the worst disaster, really. Like there's a place called Robin Hill in the middle of the island, and we had a mast up there. The actual mast strength wasn't great, so the strength really came from the guy wires that held it to the ground, a bit like those big radio towers, the guide masts. What actually happened was it was so wet that we initially used these big screws that screw into the ground, and that held the guy wire down. And because it was so wet during the storm, it actually pulled the screw right out of the ground and the whole mast bent over. We saw it go offline on monitoring, but decided it was, the weather was too bad really to do anything about it in the middle of the night. So yeah, we went up there early in the morning and the damage was quite bad. It had actually bent part of the structure of it. So we quickly got a new part for that. I think we got it. It was definitely repaired by the end of that day.
Wow.
We used to use a firm, it was a shipbuilding company that we got to make the masts. So yeah, luckily they were able to supply the new pole section pretty quickly. We just went down there and got one off of him, because it was kind of like off the shelf tubing that they used. And then we ended up getting some proper big concrete footings put in for the guy wires, so that didn't happen again. Those kind of things were kind of like the worst.
I was wondering about the maintenance of physical infrastructure and how much that must, how costly and difficult that might have become. Wind, yeah, a major enemy, and yeah. Lightning as well. Did you have any kind of interference events or kind of spectrum allocation problems with your neighbours in the radio frequency spectrum?
It's definitely a challenge. I mean, it got worse as well, as the, you know, because as more and more people got Wi-Fi routers, because obviously the frequencies you're using for the fixed wireless were mostly in the same ranges as indoor Wi-Fi. So, I mean, I remember back in the beginning, there wasn't really any interference at all. Nobody even had, you know, Wi-Fi routers indoors. And then gradually there was more and more. I mean, to be honest with you though, I think, you know, the masts were mostly in quite remote locations up on hills and things. So they didn't really suffer from local interference. The knack was more keeping the customer's router off the channel that the main incoming wireless signal was using. But we did find the routers we were using back then. I think we tried a couple actually, but I don't know if you've heard of a company called Ubiquiti. We ended up using their stuff, and the auto channel setting on the router did actually avoid the channel on the wireless backhaul. So that really worked pretty effectively. And I'd say the bigger challenge really was managing the actual frequency of the network itself, because obviously on a mast, for example, you may have three sector antennas, so each one of those is running on a different frequency. And then on some of the smaller masts, we actually used unlicensed frequency for the backhaul, so you did have to manage that. And then obviously masts could see each other in some cases, so yeah, allocating channels was definitely important. But you know, we managed to have a fairly stable, reliable service. So it was at least 95% reliability uptime. And you could tend to react to it pretty quickly, you know, if there was an issue. We had never really found the automatic channel allocation on the actual access point hardware. It never seemed to really be good enough, so we did have to manually allocate. On the busier masts, we used licensed backhaul links as well. So like a licensed microwave link that was protected by Ofcom. But due to the cost of those, you know, you needed to have a fair amount of customers to make that pay.
Let's take it on to talk about business-to-business relations. As a small island with a thriving business community, what kind of partnerships and alliances did you make?
I had a lot of business customers. I mean, they tended to be probably smaller businesses. And we actually ended up, you know, making a lot of money by providing services to the businesses as well as the actual internet service. So, for example, there's a place called the Garlic Farm, which is, originally it was just a garlic farm, but they've kind of expanded and grown to have a cafe, you know, and a little kind of tourist attraction. So like a good example is something like that, really. We initially provided them with the broadband service, and then they would actually say, oh, you know, can you put Wi-Fi around our site? And they had a few holiday cottages and things, and they'd, you know, they would like to have the connection shared. So we did quite a lot of bits and bobs like that, you know, for businesses. We did also wholesale the broadband service to other companies as well. There was an ISP on the island called White Cable back in those days. They only had very limited reach because they'd only put the cable service into some of the bigger towns. So we wholesaled to them as well to extend their reach, and that worked quite well for many years.
Can I ask, why did BT not invest in the island in that sort of way to get, you know, I'm sure they would have loved to have charged some people £50. Was it, do you know why they didn't?
It's really down to the technology that we're using, because, I mean, it did roll out DSL broadband and then later on VDSL broadband. I think we're probably a little bit behind some of the larger mainland towns, but I think in about 2003 the ADSL services were available through the telephone line. But the problem is in rural areas is that signal on the telephone line would only travel so far, so you had to be within 5 miles or so of the telephone exchange in order to get, you know, a good enough signal on your line that the broadband would work. So a lot of the really rural places like farms and small villages that didn't actually have their own telephone exchange, even though the service was available, like a lot of people just couldn't get it. Once they brought out the VDSL, which is the fibre to the cabinet service. So that was kind of how they improved on the original ADSL service that came from the telephone exchange. They put these cabinets in. Mm-hmm. So that meant that the signal was closer to the customer's phone line. So they definitely improved it. But yeah, believe it or not, I mean, that the network we built is actually still in operation by a company called Go Internet. And I mean, I must have thought over the years, like I remember back when I was doing my original variant in Freshwater, when they did launch the initial ADSL service, I think it was an 8 megabit service. I mean, I actually thought at that time that the business probably wouldn't, you know, go on much longer, but in actual fact, yeah, it just turned out not really to be the case. I think what actually happened was people became more aware of broadband. It actually caused more people to want it, you know, because you get national marketing, TV advertising and things. So yeah, in actual fact, I think we still saw growth, you know, whenever these new technologies came out from BT, they never actually seemed to impact us very much. I mean, we certainly were a niche product. I'm not going to say we were ever going to be a mass market product, and the technology wouldn't have been capable of that either. But in terms of a niche product serving the places where the BT systems didn't work properly or weren't available, yeah, I'd say it never really ended. And it, you know, it's still actually going now.
It's amazing.
I remember when I worked for an ISP, and this is 2005, and we'd have customers go offline in rural areas. He'd ring up and say, what's going on? And they'd go, well, the exchange flooded, and it's from the
1800s. Oh, no.
And yeah, we can't go in. There was one where there's a rat nest. And the schedule sometimes, because there were so many engineers they needed, you'd say, well, when's the schedule? And the computer would go, about 100 years' time.
Yeah,
because rural exchanges were not in the priority. They're low priority, low investment, because they don't bring in much money.
Yeah, this is the fundamental issue, really.
So that was where a niche came from. And there was your opportunity to make a very successful business, Chris.
Yeah, it's good.
It's not a problem that's been solved, though, is it? And even though we've got these Starlink constellations, I saw yesterday that Britain's getting nervous because every big nation state's putting up their own constellation. The Chinese want to put up 1,200. You know, Europe's got its own plan now for low Earth orbit sats. And, you know, that seems like the solution for serving rural communities. But in a way, you're pioneering, you have pioneered, and there's still an open opportunity there. I'd like us to come back, perhaps in a little while, to this issue of community ISPs and how this is still a thing. But before we go there, can I take this over to the matter of government relations? So you mentioned licensing and that you had to, you know, license certain spectrums. I presume you also had planning for setting up towers and various health and safety requirements and stuff. Generally, have you found it difficult or relatively easy with clear guidelines and things to working with regulatory authorities?
Yeah, I mean, it was all really, well, there was two, you know, planning and Ofcom really were the two key points that we dealt with. So, I mean, Ofcom, actually, I'd say a very forward thinking, actually. And back in those, especially in those early days, they were actually doing a lot to try and help these types of services. So, for example, obviously the frequency that you use and the power levels and everything are governed by regulation. So you do have to conform to the Ofcom regulation. So you can't have too high a powered radio. You take into account the emitted radiation. So that actually takes into account the antenna you're using as well. So you do have to calculate the radio power, the antenna gain, make sure you're not going above that. I mean, there's a couple of times where we did have Ofcom in touch. Like one case was there's a weather radar in, I think it's near Salisbury. I think it's the Dean Hill weather radar, and that actually uses the 5 gigahertz frequency. So one time we did actually accidentally cause interference to that weather radar. And it's a bit, I mean, it's a bit of a grey area really, whether it was, I don't think you'd say it was illegal, because with the early wireless equipment, it didn't have any inbuilt mechanism that avoided interfering with radars. It's something that came out later. Yeah, but Ofcom were always actually really, really friendly. You know, they weren't like a hard-lined regulator. They'd get in touch with you and they'd sort of say, you know, we're noticing a bit of interference. Can you fix it so you're not affecting the weather radar? And they'd give you the opportunity to just put it right, really, without taking any action. Planning, that was quite interesting, actually, because I actually managed to find I'm not sure if a loophole is the right word. I think it was in the planning law by design. But actually, there was a clause in planning that said if you had a wireless telegraphy license, you could build a mast up to 12 meters high without any planning permission. So Yeah, basically, the wireless telegraphy license could be issued either if you had a licensed point-to-point link. But there was also the 5.8 gigahertz had a sort of light licensing scheme. So it wasn't like a proper radio license where you got protected frequency. It was just a way of them kind of managing WISPs, I guess. So you had to register the locations of all your stations that ran in 5.8 gigahertz, but that actually meant you were covered under the wireless telegraphy license, under the Wireless Telegraphy Act. So I think, it was a slightly grey area whether that fully complied with the planning law, but actually on two different occasions, we did get complaints from planning, but I was able to convince them that using that clause in the law that they actually, so we never had any problems with planning. So, and we didn't actually need planning permission as long as the mast was under 12 meters high. Yeah, finding out these things and dealing with the authorities.
Sounds like you've done a very good job of navigating that, and perhaps you know some good planning advisors on the Isle of Wight.
Our good friends, Daniel and Martha. Yeah, Martha actually did help me.
I would also have thought that some complainants might object to something, the aesthetics of it, but might be persuaded by suddenly having free Wi-Fi to their home. Yeah, you don't have to answer this next one, but did you ever have any kind of 5G conspiracy theory? Well, obviously it's well before this time, but any kind of people saying that the radio waves were turning their frogs gay or something like that?
No, not really. I remember it was not long after 9/11 when we were doing some of the early stuff. And I always remember we were in the park just testing on a laptop with holding up an antenna. And some bloke came along and, said, were we Al-Qaeda or something? nothing major, no, to be quite honest with you.
Have you ever had to deal with approaches or encroachments from police, GCHQ, spooks, anybody wanting access to your logs and data and things? And I can take your silence as a form of an answer, if you like.
We never did, actually, in the early days. I mean, we did take care to make sure that we did, we were logging user sessions. So, for example, if they had come to us with a court order, we could have said who was using an IP address at a given time, but...
Nobody came in the early days and asked you to install a strange box in your cabinet then?
No, actually, we didn't. We never did get any requests. It's not, I don't think that's the case now though. Certainly when I was working at White Fiber, we did get numerous inquiries. And I think that's different nowadays, isn't it? Because I know that currently, or it has been for some time, if you're an ISP with over a certain amount of customers, and I think you do need the GCHQ box in your network, but I think just probably due to the size, of anything I've worked on, they haven't been required. I remember going to some of the broadband conferences where we met people from, much larger ISPs. And I believe what they have is, it's a kind of like, basically just a sort of transparent router, but I think it means they are able to intercept the actual data streams from any given IP address. I mean, I don't know if this is true, but I've heard that they have a way of spoofing SSL certificates so they can kind of act as a man in the middle. So they are able to encrypt the traffic.
That's right, yeah. That's why end-to-end is very important.
Yeah.
So on a similar subject of cybersecurity, I suppose in the early days, cybersecurity wasn't really a huge thing, and we'd probably be horrified to think about what was just out in the open in plain text then. But how have you seen ISP cybersecurity evolve over the years, and how have we got from where we were then to a sort of typical setup now?
I mean, I was thinking about that actually. I mean, I think back in the early days, there was just as many viruses and things. And actually, I'd say, like, you know, especially Windows probably was more susceptible. There was more vulnerabilities, I think, in those days, especially in the web browsers. So remember, especially in the Windows XP days, almost everybody would get a virus at some point. I think what's changed is that they weren't, it's the financial aspect of it now, isn't it? I mean, back in those days, I think they just tended to knacker your computer. And there was some key loggers and things that enabled bank fraud. But I think on the whole, they just weren't as financially damaging to people.
It was a very, very different landscape of motives then. And now it would specifically want to target ISPs to get inside the infrastructure and be hidden inside the infrastructure of an ISP, because that would be a very juicy target.
Yeah. I mean, I think we always had bots scanning, and so we always needed to be good at firewalling so that nothing could actually establish a connection. I mean, what we tended to do was we had what you'd call a DCN. So that's essentially a sort of private VLAN network within the network that's privately addressed. So it's not actually, so the majority of the equipment isn't actually reachable from the internet side, if that makes sense. So you manage it, you manage the equipment on local IP addresses. The public addressing tends to sit on the customer side. Or you do have public addresses on things like web servers and stuff, but yeah, the firewalling means that unless there's an actual vulnerability in the web server itself, you know, there's not too much possibility of issues.
In internal control network, and most of the boxes are running things like BSD and Linux and things.
That's
like
right,
that.
Yeah, which is kind of inherent, you know, the whole design architecture of the Unix and Linux systems is inherently more secure than Windows. I mean, that doesn't mean to say you don't still get the odd vulnerability, but luckily they tend to be, you know, fairly rare. I think one thing that's different nowadays is, I think back in the old days with security, it was more like you needed to know in a more technical level what you needed to do. But I think nowadays, well, you'll know more about this than me, but I think nowadays it's more to do with general policy, isn't it? Keeping everything updated, you know, good cybersecurity practices. So yeah, always have the latest software versions, that kind of thing.
So Chris, so much has changed in terms of technology. We're into the era now of 6G, which I believe is in the sort of 20 gigahertz, 30 gigahertz band. And LoRa, which is a change in licensing that allows lower frequencies, I think the old pager bands from 900 megahertz and things. And this is opening up a new era of community networks. What do you know about that, and what advice might you have to small groups who want to set up their own rural ISPs?
Well, I mean, I still do a bit of work actually with this company called Go Internet, who eventually purchased the old network that I built. I think LoRaWAN isn't really a broadband technology that you could use for an ISP because it's very low bandwidth. It's good for, you know, controlling pieces of equipment and that kind of thing, for as long as it doesn't require too much bandwidth. So yeah, I think that would tend to be more used. Perhaps, I mean, you might have it on a farm, maybe, where you've got some equipment that you're controlling remotely, but it's fairly long distance, I believe. I can't remember the actual figures on it, but it's a sort of a low frequency signal, which means it travels better. But yeah, very low bandwidth though. But yeah, in terms of wireless ISPs. I think there's been a few developments, actually. They have, Ofcom have actually now released a frequency in the 20 gigahertz range, which an ISP can actually license. So I think that's potentially a game changer for a community ISP, because it means you can actually license your frequency. So that will actually protect you from interference, so you can do proper frequency planning, you know, in the same way that the mobile networks would do. So that's quite new, though. I know the guys I do some work with, they had some gear. It's relatively expensive, though. So whether it's feasible for a very small project, possibly not. But then obviously you do have, they have extended the Wi-Fi frequency now up to 6 gigahertz. So there's a bit more frequency available. I mean, one issue is, though, that the channel widths, because obviously people demand higher and higher data rates. What's ended up happening is the equipment uses wider and wider channels. So if, you know, if you go back to the 2.4 gigahertz frequency, I think it only had the entire available frequency only had a bandwidth of 40 megahertz. So
some 14 theoretical channels in there, I think.
Something like that. Yeah, assuming you have a 5 megahertz or 10 megahertz channel. But actually nowadays, the newer Wi-Fi standards have like 40 or 80 or even 160 megahertz channel widths. So actually, you know, your average home router now pretty much uses up most of the spectrum. But they're doing like clever things with technologies like MIMO and beamforming is the other one. So even though it's using up, you know, a huge swathe of channel, what they're actually doing is directing the signal on a beam. So it points it towards the client. So then you can actually reuse the same frequency on another beam.
Can you do that with a single antenna, or do you need a fancy array antenna?
Yeah, they're called a phase array, those kind of things. I think some of the latest routers do claim to use it. I'm not quite sure actually on Wi-Fi whether it enables reuse of the same frequency. I know with LTE technology and the mobile carriers LTE, they certainly do have those kind of capabilities. And they've also got this thing called massive MIMO. So effectively, all of the masts in the network kind of operate as a cloud. So in actual fact, your iPhone could be receiving beams from actually multiple masts. So it's getting very clever, you know, frequency reuse and that kind of thing. It's certainly getting very smart rather than just, you know, bunging everything down a single signal.
Now, some of this technology is also getting very cheap. Although flags have been raised about possible cybersecurity problems, especially with 5G equipment that's coming from China.
Yeah.
Are you cautious about that? Do you see a danger in, I mean, surely it would be fairly obvious when you've installed a piece of equipment if it were sending packets off to a foreign nation, but the real concern is backdoors in these devices. What do you feel about or know about these?
Well, I think the government have banned Huawei telecom kit, haven't they? I believe you're not allowed to use Huawei.
I think that's correct. Yeah.
Well, this is very difficult to say, isn't it? I'm not aware that anybody's ever actually proven that there is communications going on. I mean, it's something I actually thought quite a lot about, really, because one thing we did notice on ISP networks is oversized ICMP packets. So I'm not sure if you're aware of it, but actually it is possible to insert a payload into an ICMP packet. So the
or a DNS request. I've had a system called Iodine that I used for a while to just tunnel things over DNS requests. And yeah, you'd notice that those packets were fatter than normal. Did you ever figure out what was in them?
No, never figured out what was in them, but I was certain that there is a lot of suspicious traffic. And I think I had another thought, is what they actually do is they spoof the reply address. So you could send a ping, just an everyday ping ICMP with a payload. You could spoof the source address so that almost any, you know, web server or router on the internet would send that back somewhere else. So it would go somewhere else. So I've always been convinced that there's hidden networks operating like that inside of ICMP packets. I'm certain of it. We could see strange things like that. We knew that the packet originated from a customer on the network, but you could see that the source address in the packet wasn't from that true source. So I always suspected it was some sort of bot network or secret communication network, you know, and there's bound to be things no one's thought of.
You know, they have thought of them and they haven't investigated them. And and these things are only getting worse and worse, as we'll know from our other episodes, and especially this week, our cyber war episode, that these things are increasing at a hell of a clip. And there's a message out there for any British investors: invest in British Wi-Fi or European technologies and things that, especially free open source versions of things that can be inspected, because remember, trust but verify. And if you can't verify, all bets are off. You need to be able to look at that source code, and you need to be able to verify that the source code that you're seeing is what's actually running on the chip.
Yeah, that's right.
So, Chris, what new projects are in your sights at the moment, and how might people reach you for any business dealing that they're interested in at the moment?
I basically worked on the White Fiber Gigabit Island project over the last 8 years, and that was building a full fiber network on the Isle of Wight. Throughout the design and build of that, I actually left just before the end of last year. So at the moment, I'm just doing consultancy services. I'm working with a bunch of local IT firms, and the company Go Internet that I mentioned, that actually bought the original network that I built. I'm doing a bit of that. And I've also set up a company with my sister, who's a conveyancing solicitor. And I've developed a document backup and sharing solution. It's kind of designed around the conveyancing process, with the idea that it will enable the clients to upload the documents that the solicitor is looking for, share them with the solicitor, and then you can actually then transfer them to the new owner of the property. So we haven't quite launched that yet, but it's pretty much being developed now.
What's the name of that venture?
It's called Verturio Tech Limited is the actual company name that we've established. The domain name will be verturio.com, and that's verturio.com.
Active yet?
It's not active yet, I'm afraid. It is due to launch soon. It's for testing, but yeah, we should be launching that fairly soon.
Great. We'll ask you to come back when you've got more news on that subject. Well, Chris, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the Cyber Show. I'm sure that our listeners are fascinated by what goes on behind the scenes with an ISP, and there's no better way to learn about this than examining a small business and how it's built and how that's all put together. I wish you a lot of luck with all your future ventures, and thanks for joining us on the Cyber Show.
Thanks for joining us on the Cyber Show, Chris. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me.
Thanks, Chris.
Hello, guys.
Bye.